Welcome to the Money and Time Machine podcast, where you can learn how to rage against the theft of your financial future by listening to a unique perspective on what's holding you back from a life of more money and more time.
Hello and welcome back to the Money and Time Machine podcast. This is episode 21, the Money Lender Part 2. So hopefully you enjoyed the first part of my interview with Jody Carl from Sterling Finance. This is the continuation of that interview. And the reason I did it, look, I could have very easily have wrapped that up in about an hour and 10 minutes and condensed it, but such was the nature of that sort of dialogue that I really felt it important to break it down into two episodes. And I feel very strongly that if you are, you are in debt, and this is something that you might find useful, that, you know, it really pays to really understand what Jody is sharing with you at a very, very deep level, enough for you to incite you at least to take some decisive action and actually see if you could actually do better. So, look, I hope you go on and enjoy the rest of this. So I'll continue the episode, and we'll speak shortly. Take care.
Now, I'm going to talk about something you and I discussed. I started to look into superannuation well over a decade ago. And, when things happen like a divorce, and it really awakens you, and I realized how naive and ignorant I was on many facets. And the sobering statistics about the realities of life post-work isn't impressive. You know, I'm in that top percentile. And though I would be the first to say something is better than nothing, I personally, for many years, put stock in this fairy tale that the government will look after my interests and look after me by way of the money I will have accrued over my working years, until that careful study that I did. I realized that with better access to information, I could take that knowledge and perform better than the mystery people that I will never meet and never know. So I've been managing my own super, but my question is just a personal one. What are your thoughts on superannuation?
Justin, my husband and I have never really liked the fact the government can change the rules governing superannuation at any time in any way they feel justified. We have tried to manage our own future wealth, security and superannuation by way of buying and managing quality properties that provide good yield and capital growth. We still have superannuation that we pay into, and I think it's important that everyone does do that. Hmm. It's good to have a diversity of avenues of income and wealth generation. In the past, we've bought and sold shares, and as you know, we've bought a business with dire consequences, but our focus has always been on property. You can buy and hold property, you can pay off debt as fast or as slow as you wish, you can increase the value of a property if it's able to be subdivided, and by buying well in the right areas at the right time. I mean, buying property isn't foolproof. You have to do the research and know what you're doing.
Yes.
You can make mistakes in any asset class. There's no guarantees in any of them. However, although we've made mistakes, as I've alerted to, we have learnt from them. Property is a very long-term strategy, and it requires you to educate yourself, put time into the management of your property. Although we do get property managers to do that, we manage our property managers, because no one's going to look after your financial resources as well as what you will.
Yes.
You've got a vested interest in it. And we ensure that when we do buy them, we buy using correct structures, entities, and we review insurances and finances frequently. So there is a lot of work with any sort of investing, but the more you educate yourself about a particular type of investing, the better you're likely to do in it.
Yes. Well said. And, I think one of the things that attracted me to you was, I sense a good heart-to-heart. I've had a few finance brokers in the past, and look, they were brilliant, but I just couldn't break through the facade, and I just feel more comfortable when I feel as though, both parties have an understanding. Now, I heard one of my former finance brokers use the term churning, but they refused to elaborate about its meaning. I suspect it was an in-house reference, and he wanted to maintain a professional look. So when I asked the question, I got the wall. Have you heard of the term? And what is it synonymous with?
Yes, I have. Churning is refinancing clients every couple of years, usually unnecessarily. And that's changing their banks on an ongoing basis. And we've already talked about the cost to do so. Mm. So there has to be a cost benefit to change a client from one lender to another. And sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. At the end of the day, it's the client's decision. But this is what would have resulted if the Royal Commission had their way in getting rid of our industry or trying to get rid of our industry and getting rid of our trailing commissions. Our trailing commissions aren't really money for dam, as the Royal Commission, as it was sort of touted to be by some of the big four.
Yes.
It's actually a deferred commission payment that we've already earned by doing the loan. Refinancing is not good or bad, but it depends on why you're doing it. It must be just fallen. A cost benefit to do that basically. But just to go back to trailing commissions, it was initially instituted by the big four banks, even though now they've decided they want to get rid of it. And the reason they put it in is it was a way of reducing our applications, which discouraged the whole churning phenomenon by delaying payment to brokers. And those who left their clients at the bank they initially put them with. So if they did try to churn their clients, they weren't going to get the full payment that they had earned upfront putting the client with that particular bank.
I'm with you.
If they were churned, then the lenders would not pay the full upfront commission, but by way of trailing commissions, that's how they paid the full commission. And basically the client needed to be there for, you know, at least two to four years. Their public campaign was that they believed we were earning money for jam, which was certainly inflammatory, and giving the public a view of us that was really not, we weren't entitled to be receiving what we were earning. Further, brokers annually, we review our clients to ensure ongoing appropriateness of the bank product to ensure that the rates stay optimised at the bank. If the bank doesn't stay competitive, then the broker will let the client know of other refinancing options that provide a cost benefit and leave the decision to the client to stay at that bank or to refinance. Brokers basically provide information, answer questions, do the research and the work in getting or changing financing arrangements. We don't really make the decision. At the end of the day, the client makes that decision.
No, absolutely, as it should be. I'll ask you this question. We live in an age when access to money is important from the system's perspective, because our economy is predicated on debt. You know, 80% of our economy is based on this continuous consumption cycle. And that brings me to payday lenders with astronomical interest rates that, by the way of, you know, by the way they are advertising as being a standard practice. And people have become desensitized to them, almost what I consider their insidious impact for those people that fall short. But they are illegal in every sense of the word, and they appear to target the most vulnerable and least suspecting because of the circumstances that prevail that leave many of these unsuspecting target market almost desperate for any financial solution. Even if in the T's and C's, a prudent person might run a mile. I think they've heard the term panic, or I've heard the term panic button lending. Is that something that you're familiar with?
Yes, and I have had clients who suffered as a result come to me afterwards trying to refinance that debt to better rates and fees, or even unsuccessfully trying to obtain finance for other reasons as a result of a payday lender being listed on their credit files. Payday lenders quote repayment amounts per month, which don't sound bad to the consumer, but most end up being 48% per annum interest in their overall cost. In addition to that, the big four and the other second-tier lenders either won't subsequently lend to clients who have used payday lenders in the past, even up to where they may have paid that payday lender off 12 months ago, or may offer rates that reflect a higher risk because the client looks like they may have been desperate in getting the payday lender. They are the lender of last resort, so my advice is to stay away from them. Unfortunately, they do appeal to the desperate and the time-poor clientele who may need urgent finance, don't understand finance, or have very little time to research options and financial costs involved.
Thanks for that, Jody. I always suspected that was the case, but I to hear it from someone in your industry, I think speaks volumes for, you know, why you should be so cautious when it comes to payday lenders. It would appear that you can't talk about finance without talking about a taboo subject, that of financial discrimination, something you and I discussed at length. And I felt it after my divorce. I went from being a reliable mortgage holder and paid my loan diligently. And after the divorce, in my bid to come up with viable solutions to keep my house, I couldn't help but feel as though I had become a liability. Is financial circumstance or discrimination, I should say, fast becoming that elephant in the room? You know, lending institutions don't want to acknowledge it, and if they do, they use technical verbiage greased up with the, you know, with the shame of the client who is desperate for a solution.
Yes, unfortunately, the discrimination's probably always been there, but probably becoming more noticeable with social media and you know, with more people becoming a bit more savvy about their lending options and using brokers. The only two institutions that can do this sort of discrimination is religious groups and banks. However, there is a degree of understanding why banks can and will do this, and it's summed up by the fact that they are businesses who need to make money to survive and pay dividends to shareholders to the level that keeps them invested or attracts new shareholders. It all comes down to risk mitigation. Anywhere there is a risk, the bank will decide either to do or not to do the deal, or adjust the rates or fees to mitigate that risk and make it worthwhile to the deal being done. A bit like a tradie who you get to come out to your house, who looks at the job, decides they don't want it, so they'll price it such that it will discourage you from enlisting their services. Or if you do decide to enlist their services, the tradie will be adequately rewarded for the level that will justify him doing the job at all. So it comes down to reward for risk. Discrimination comes via banks' credit policy, and it dictates who they will or won't lend to and on what terms. So if you don't pay your bills on time every time, then your credit file will reflect this, and the bank may not lend to you or will adjust your rates and fees to justify the risk of doing so. In terms of divorce, where property and assets, including cash or income, is divided or reduced because an added maintenance payment is to be made, it will affect your borrowing capacity, but it works against both parties, including the party receiving the maintenance. For the party paying the maintenance, it's obvious that it will reduce their borrowing capacity, but for the party who is receiving it, the maintenance has to be child support agents registered and able to be proven that it is being paid on time every time by the non-custodial parent. So non-custodial parents can severely impact their ex-partner, who is the custodial parent, from being able to buy a house to provide security to the children who predominantly live with them. So it works both ways. So even though you may be entitled to the child support, if your partner isn't paying it on time every time, the bank can preclude that income from being used in the assessment of what your borrowing capacity is. Further, parents receiving any Centrelink payments where children are over a certain age, it's around about 12 years old, are not able to include this income to determine their borrowing capacity. I could go on and on about all the different policies that impact clients and maximum borrowing capacity to the level that they need. Banks still prefer permanent full-time workers over part-time, casual or contract, and even more so self-employed clients who find it really difficult to get loans. Just as an aside, I was speaking to a bank manager the other day and they were saying that, you know, pretty much if you could stand up and breathe, you'd pretty much get the loan. But now he's seeing 3 out of every 10 applications being approved. So 70% of applications going even through a bank branch are not being approved. And that's another reason why I believe a broker is a good person to use, because we're not going to go put in your application with a lender that we believe is going to be declined. We will be 99.9% sure of the fact that, you know, your application is going to be approved before we would even start to think about, you know, putting that application with that lender. It all comes down to perceived risk a client poses to the bank's eyes with regards to risk mitigation. So another good, yeah, and I've talked about, you know, we don't discriminate. We use your circumstances to find you the best possible solution based on your life circumstances that a client may have. So I guess the big message here is don't be rate focused. Think about the fact that your circumstances are, you know, particular to you, and there may be certain lenders out there that will and won't lend to you. So it's a matter of us finding the best lender based on your circumstances, and then we look at rate. We of course we want to get you the best rate, but the best rate out in the marketplace may be a lender that won't lend to you.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, thank you, Jody, for that level of honesty and transparency there, and giving the listener an insight into, I guess, the thinking behind banks when it comes to issues related that might affect or impact your borrowing capacity. Now, Jody, there was a time when banks were big on customer loyalty. It seems that was a was a long time ago. You know, banks are a business, yeah, and you mentioned it earlier, and they're in the business of saddling you with debt. So loyalty is not high on their criteria, I suspect. Sometimes you say, you have to, and this is from your perspective, you have to disappoint your clients because, one, they haven't met a particular lending institution's criteria, and two, even if they do, you feel you have a sense of obligation to advise your clients that even though they have been approved, there are elements of the deal that mightn't be in their best interest. So, you know, what does a conversation like that involve? Because sometimes to negotiate a deal, you've mentioned this, it involves a percentage equity losses, but the client doesn't always want to hear the truth. And by the truth, I mean the facts of the matter. So how do you go about having that conversation?
Well, banks are money shops, basically. Loyalty used to be quite a big thing. You'd have a relationship with a banking manager and they would look after you. There wasn't that much choice back then anyway, and banks were all fairly similar. But loyalty doesn't really play a role anymore. Being knowledgeable like a broker carries more weight with banks because they know, that is the banks, that we know their individual credit policies, their niches and risk appetites. The reason brokers are gaining more market share is because we look after the client's best interests and don't just sell products. This can be highlighted by the fact that when we review the client's loans periodically, comparing their rates with the rates of, you know, their own bank and what they're offering new clients or the wider market or what the wider market is offering, we almost always see the disparity and have to negotiate with their own bank to get their rates reduced. Banks aren't going to offer their existing clients special deals they are offering new clients unless the client knows about them in the first place or is knowledgeable about other banks' rates and whether or not they comply with other banks' policies, such as the chance of successful refinance, if assured. The broker knows this. Just an aside, we get approximately 24 emails a day from lenders updating us on interest rates and fees, credit policy changes or new credit policy introductions, new products. We're constantly being bombarded with emails. So it's actually quite a job to stay on top of all of this. And because it's our full-time job, we can. Yes. It'd be very, very hard for a client to understand the intricacies of all the different banks' credit policies, know what all the rates and fees are, and know whether or not they're actually going to be approved or declined. So I certainly, even if I got out of this game, I would not be going directly to a bank. I would be always going through a broker just to make sure that, you know, all my ducks are in a row and I've got the best possible chance of being approved.
Well said. I wish I'd met you a decade ago, Jody. Honest, but look, I'm eternally grateful for just having this conversation because I think it's something that too many of us in the marketplace are unaware of. And I'm pretty sure it's a case of, you know, when you have good information, you end up making much better decision and much better choices. So let's finish off on a good note. You know, one of the things your clients love about you, and it was always my sense of you, and now knowing your story, it makes perfect sense to me now. You get people ready to buy. And so I'll explain, you know, you're a finance broker. You're a coach. You're counsel. You prep your clients. It's not, you know, if not in the first instance when you have met them, the lending institution criteria may not always be ideally suited. And also for some who are not having not met that criteria, you prime them. So you get them ready for the ins and outs, so that when they do apply again, after being rejected months or years prior, to reapply with confidence and having them, you know, because you've built them up to look stronger and more attractive. What does that process look like and involve?
Oh, absolutely. Sometimes I see clients 12 to 18 months before they're ready to successfully obtain finance. And I recommend that as soon as you're even thinking about borrowing money in any form or for any purpose, you contact your broker to ensure that you get your ducks in a row, so that, you know, the outcome is likely, you know, it's almost 100% going to happen. There are four C's for successful financing that need to occur, and I'll just touch on each of them. So there's basically the banks look at your credit file, which demonstrates your character to make, you know, payments on time every time. They look at your capacity. I'll go into that in a sec. Capital and collateral. So Touching on each of them briefly, your credit file, this reflects your character and your financial management in being able to make all payments of all your commitments on time, every time, and to not go over them. And more importantly, not displaying a desperation for finance by applying to every institution, or worse, applying to pay the lenders because you're desperate and have no ability to delay your credit application. So something else I'd like to say with this credit file, we've swapped now from what we call a negative credit reporting system under VEDA to a positive comprehensive credit reporting system under what's now called Equifax. The way it works is you would think it'd be better to go from a negative to a positive, but it is and it isn't. So the negative reporting system we had before, if you did something really bad, so you know, bankruptcy or you're constantly paying things late or you don't pay them, you get a listing on your credit file and it would affect you adversely.
Yeah.
But minor infractions didn't. Now we have a positive comprehensive credit reporting system where everything is recorded month on month. So every time you open something, there'll be a credit inquiry. You'll also have up to 2 or 3 years of repayment history, and there's codes 123, 12345 or something, and then there's a cross, or there's different codes that apply which are listed on your credit file. For example, if you have a zero, there's no credit file, or if it's a C, it's closed, or if something you haven't paid something within 7 to 14 days, you get a 1. If it's over 30 days, I think it's a 2. Over 60 days, it's a 3. Over 4, it might be over 90 days, it might be a 4. And if you're 100 days over, or you're basically defaulting on your home loan, it's an X.
Yes.
And these issues, they're basically giving the bank so much more information about you for them to then make more discerning decisions about whether or not they want to lend to you, or whether they feel this is coming, that they're going to start to adjust rates according to the risk that you pose to them. So it's a very detailed system. It's like the old school report card you'd come home, but this is your report card for finance for life.
Yes.
And although credit files can be fixed over time or made worse over time, you need to really make sure that you pay all your bills on time, every time, don't go over limits, be really, really careful. Your broker can actually do a credit file check on you without leading a credit file inquiry, and it allows me to make sure that I don't put you with a lender that will decline you, but it also allows you to look at your credit file and make sure that everything on there is the truth, because we do find that there are mistakes listed on different credit files at different times. I had one, I think I spent 4 days doing the application, collecting documents. It was quite a complex deal.
Yeah.
And as soon as I lodged it, within 30 seconds, I had a decline. And straight away, it was like, oh, either something the client has not told me, or there's a mistake. As it turned out, there was a mistake. We got it rectified within the next 30 days, but that client couldn't then apply to that lender for another 6 months. And that lender happened to be the best option for the financing requirements they were seeking.
I'm with you.
So it's really, really important to look after your credit file. So that's one of them. Now, the capacity. This comes down to this comes from stability of your employment over time, the demand for your skills, and the level of income that you earn. Then whether or not you can live within your means after deducting your monthly living expenses and any other liability commitments or loans, credit cards that you have to make good on. So what is left over has to be enough to cover any new or applied for credit or loans, to the extent that you can just make them based on the current interest rate that you're paying, but also you're able to make them if the interest rate rises by 2 to 3% above what you originally applied for, as well as comfortably being able to maintain your lifestyle without putting you into hardship. This is called responsible lending, and brokers and banks have to comply with this. But as I said before, brokers also have to comply with best interest duty for looking after the client's interests. But this capacity thing is a fairly objective measure, and it's one of the things that's hardest to improve, because you may not have the skills to earn a higher income. You may have a certain job classification and there is no higher level of income. You can always reduce your expenses to ensure that excess income after any commitments you have to pay, but there sometimes is only so much you can do in that area as well. So that's number two, that's capacity, borrowing capacity, that is. Capital. Now, this is the money that you say to put towards any purchase. So You could have been gifted money, or you could have gained it through increases in equity from your property, or you could have just saved money over time. Any capital growth you get in your property is equity. And you know, you can use equity from one property to contribute towards a purchase of another, which requires bank funding.
Yeah.
There will be minimum levels required by each bank that you should also take into account. So the minimum level with different funders, for example, Keystart requires 2% money to be saved over a 3-month period. Most of the lenders will require at least 5%. Some may require 10% in terms of buying an investment property. But in addition to that, you've also got your purchasing costs. When you're a first-time buyer, your purchasing costs are generally limited if you're likely to get the stamp duty exemption, which means that up to $430,000 purchase, there's no stamp duty to be paid. And then above that level, you pay 20 cents in the dollar. And then after a $530,000 purchase, there is no stamp duty exemption. So there are ways of reducing the purchase costs in terms of a first home buyer. For the rest of us who've already owned our first home, and buying subsequent ones, upgrading, downgrading, or whatever, generally the rule of thumb is that whatever you're buying, you apply the 5% rule. So if you're buying a $500,000 property, 5% of $500,000 is $25,000. So in addition to your deposit that you're putting towards your purchase, you have to be able to fund about 5% purchase costs.
I'm with you.
Now, if you're selling a property to buy another one, when you sell your property, you deduct the loan from what you sell your property for. Then you have to deduct a further 3% selling costs, and that gives you your funds to go towards your next purchase. And then your next purchase, you have to factor in 5% purchase costs. So any sort of changeover from one house to another, you're effectively losing anything, you know, up to around about 10% of your equity.
Interesting.
So brokers work all that out for you. You don't need to work that out. So the more capital contributed, or the more money you put towards something, or the more equity you have to put towards it, or gifted funds, the lower the funding is required, then the lower the loan-to-value ratio, which is always a good thing. Remember that the golden number is 80%,
yeah,
of which you get best rates for what you're borrowing, and the fact that you don't have to pay lenders mortgage insurance. And getting under that 80%, certainly, the more you save, the less you borrow, the better the chances are of your loan being approved and the better your chance of getting better rates. So that's quite important to remember that. Now, I just want to compare to – so we've talked about credit file number one, capacity number two, and capital number three. I want to just briefly mention capacity versus capital.
Yes, please.
Usually when we see clients, usually one will be stronger than the other. So sometimes clients will have better capacity and the weakness is their capital, what they've saved or equity that they have available to them. Sometimes it's the other way around. They've got these fantastic deposits, or they've got good equity in their home, but their income minus their outgoings limits their borrowing capacity. So having capacity is obviously the better one to have because you're earning more income. It's always easier to save more money. And I always say, you know, when someone's going for a loan and they're not quite in the right position at that time, save, and save some more.
Yep.
Okay? That is definitely the golden rule. But capacity is harder to change. Capital is easier to change. So definitely better if you have got the capacity. It's just a matter of time before you'll have the capital. Now, the last one, collateral, this is the easiest one to achieve. This is basically whatever you're looking to buy, hopefully you're not paying too much for it. Generally, real estate agents are pretty good at pricing what they're selling. You know, generally the actual sale price will end up being maybe a little bit lower than the listing price, though depending on the market. We have had a situation where gazumping was occurring a few years ago when the market was red hot and people were almost turning up and auctioning for the property without it being an auction. So they were gazumping. Other people were offering less or offering the asking price, and they were offering more because they wanted the property. That's when we're in a real boom situation.
Not that long ago.
At the moment. So this is usually the item of funding used to purchase the property, business asset or, you know, motor vehicle or equipment. In the case of unsecured funding, this isn't an issue because secured funding is where you have an asset that the bank takes puts a mortgage on. Unsecured funding is generally money that you are being granted based on you putting forward a proposition. A personal loan is an unsecured fund. Business loans tend to be unsecured unless property is used to secure it. So rates will be higher with unsecured funding as opposed to secured funding because there is more risk with unsecured funding because there's no asset to be sold if the bank needs to recover their money.
Thank you ever so much for that, Jody. You know, and I'll say it again, I wish I'd met you a decade ago. I'd recommend anybody entertaining the idea of using the service of a finance broker, listen to this podcast first and foremost. And with that being said, Jody, I give all of my guests the opportunity. If someone's listening to this podcast, how can they get in touch with you?
Sure. Well, my mobile number is 0411 967 954. Otherwise, I have an email address. It's Jody, J-O-D-I, at Sterling Finance, Sterling with an E, not an I, .com.au.
No, thank you, Jody. And what I'll do on www.moneyandtimemachine.com, when you click on the podcast section and you check out this particular interview, if the listener clicks on the show notes, I'll actually insert your emails and contact details there. So rest assured, if they're scrolling through it and come across, that'll be the other way they get in touch with you. Jody, that has been an education in its own right. And look, when I had a coffee with you, you know, I thought 5-10 minutes tops. And, you know, I guess you just... the information, the quality of the information which you shared, which is fairly similar there, just confirmed why it is I had to have you on there. So thank you very much for your time, because I know you're a very busy lady. We're running your own business, working from home, going and seeing clients when they need to be seen. So thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome, Justin. It's been a pleasure, and thank you very much for the opportunity. And I hope to all those who are listening that this has provided you with some value going forward. And yeah, all the best to everyone. Thank you.
There you have it, an honest perspective of how you can get the best from your finance broker. This was not meant to be an indictment on finance broking. It's a perspective that is designed to empower you to be more bold and to look out for your best interests and to find finance brokers whose values are more aligned with yours. And you will always do, and will, I should say they will always do what's in your best interest. In an industry, there are those who mightn't think it necessary to do the very best they can for you. That's okay. As Jody suggested, every industry has them. The idea here is that you can arm yourself to be in a better position to find those that are. An interesting little-known fact. When a patient who had done some research about their respective cancer diagnosis and potential availability of better-known cure options, the doctor almost invariably shied away from promoting the standard care options. When the patient used medical jargon they appeared to understand, even if at just a rudimentary level, the doctors were more careful to think about what he or she would say. Interesting, isn't it? So, if you have any queries or would like to get in touch with Jody Carl, she's relayed information, as I said, I'll make sure to avail it, at least her email and mobile, in the notes section of my podcast. But till next we meet, please stay safe and speak soon.
Thanks for listening to the Money and Time Machine podcast. And remember, you're either someone else's version of a money and time machine, or you can learn how to become your very own effective money and time machine and to live with purpose on purpose.